Iran is signing the bilateral security agreement with the U.S., which will keep up to 10,000 U.S. soldiers there, something Hamid Karzai wasn't willing to sign.
Well, again, Dostum is quite a divisive character. The reason that Afghani wanted him on board was largely the Uzbek vote, but also his representation, if you like, in the north. Afghani is well known amongst the Pashtun population. He needs to carry the north with him if they're going to keep Afghanistan together and keep the battle against the Taliban going. So in that way, you know, he had very, very little choice. The real power in northern Afghanistan is not him, and it's not even Abdullah Abdullah, it's another man entirely. But Dostum is, if you like, a middleman to them who can actually keep it together. But it's frankly a shocking state of affairs when a man who has been accused of being a murderer by his own president is now the vice president. It's beyond my understanding.
Jamie Duran, we want to thank you for being with us. Independent documentary filmmaker. We'll link to our broadcast of the film Afghan Massacre, The Convoy of Death. That does it for our broadcast, Democracy Now!, produced by Mike Burke, Renee Feltz, Nermeen Sheikh, Steve Martinez, Sam Alkoff, Hani Massoud, Ravi Karan, Dina Guzder, Amy Littlefield, Daniel Begun, Anna Ozbeck, and Sam Riddell, Mike DiFilippo, Miguel Noguera, engineer. Special thanks to Becca Staley, Julie Crosby, Hugh Grand, Jessica Lee, Vesta Goddars. I'm Amy Goodman with Aaron Maté, our website, democracynow.org.
You are listening to KBOO Portland, 90.7 FM, also heard around the world at www.kbu.fm. The time is 5:01. Stay tuned for the KBOO Evening News. And this KBOO program has been made possible in part by KBOO Foundation members and a grant from Volunteers of America Oregon, committed by helping 17,000 vulnerable people of all ages in our community live better lives each year. You can learn more on how to help by visiting the website at voaor.org.
Join us for our monthly movie event, KBOO at the Clinton. This month, on October 9th, KBOO will host a screening of The U.S. vs. John Lennon, a 2006 documentary film about John Lennon and his transformation from Beatle to anti-war activist and the repression he faced because of his political activities. That's KBOO at the Clinton with The U.S. vs. John Lennon on Thursday, October 9th at the Clinton Street Theater, 2522 Southeast Clinton Street in Portland. More information is available at kboo.fm on the right-hand side of the homepage under Community Events.
Tune into KBOO on Wednesday, October 1st for Turning the Tide on Climate Change.
An all-day special about climate change and the actions we must take now.
And don't miss a special guest, Naomi Klein, talking about her new book, This Changes Everything, Capitalism versus the Climate at 1 p.m.
That's Turning the Tide on Climate Change on Wednesday, October 1st, 8 a.m., 4 p.m. on
KBOO Portland.
And now, your daily volunteer-produced community newscast, the KBOO Evening News.
Coming up on the KBOO Evening News, the first confirmed case of Ebola in the United States is diagnosed in Texas.
Protesters in Ferguson, Missouri renew their calls for justice for Michael Brown.
A judge in Detroit declares that water is not a human right.
Good evening. This is the KBOO Evening News for Tuesday, September 30th, 2014. I'm Emily Young.
And I'm Theo Burke. The Portland State University Board of Trustees will decide whether to move forward with the recommendation of a spring task force to create an armed campus police force. Proponents of the change claim the creation of a campus police force will improve public safety. Opponents are concerned about the presence of guns on campus and police abuse. Currently, PSU uses a unit of public safety officers, or unsworn officers. Such officers do not carry guns, cannot investigate off-campus crimes, or issue warrants. Eric Knoll, this year's president of the student government, characterized the issue as divisive, with some students in favor and some students opposed. The University of Oregon and the Oregon Health Sciences Center have instituted armed police forces.
The University of Oregon is under scrutiny for the hiring of Adam Ritz, a convicted sex offender. Ritz, a former disc jockey at an Indiana radio station, was convicted of sexual battery of a 22-year-old woman in 2004. He has since become a controversial figure amongst many on college campuses for the motivational talks he gives. Ritz recently gave a talk to the University of Oregon football team, which outraged many in the student body and faculty. University of Oregon Professor Carol Stabile, who is co-chair of the Faculty Senate Task Force to Address Sexual Violence and Survivor Support, believed that the hiring of Ritz sent the wrong message.
California police will now be able to use surveillance drones without obtaining a warrant. A bill passed by the state legislature to limit the police use of drones has been vetoed by Governor Jerry Brown. The California governor has been criticized in the past by privacy advocates for vetoing a number of bills meant to protect Californians' privacy. Brown said that the bill's provisions appear to be too narrow and could impose requirements beyond what is required by the Fourth Amendment of the U.S. Constitution. But supporters say that Brown's claims are overstated. They say that the exceptions include use of drones without warrants for emergency situations, search and rescue efforts, traffic, first responders, and inspection of wildfires. It would also allow other public agencies to use drones for other purposes, just not law enforcement.
A 79-year-old protester will be sentenced tomorrow for up to a year in prison for protesting U.S. drones. Jack Gilroy is a member of the Upstate Drone Coalition in New York State. Gilroy was convicted of trespass and obstructing government administration. The trial was based on participation in a solemn funeral procession and a die-in to illustrate the death and destruction of innocent people by drone missiles. The protest was held at the Hancock Air Force Base near Syracuse. Hancock is one of many drone bases around the United States doing assassinations of Muslim suspects in foreign nations. Gilroy had an opportunity to plead guilty without penalty, but refused, saying that the guilty are not those who carry the message to stop the killing. Gilroy and scores of others who were arrested at the gates of the 174th Attack Wing all took oaths of nonviolence. The wave of nonviolent resistance to drone warfare by the 174th Air National Guard has been ongoing for the past 4 years. On Sunday, October 5th, the Upstate Coalition to Ground the Drones and End the Wars will be hosting a permitted street theater, including bicyclists against drone warfare, artists, teachers, and others against drone warfare. The weekend's event is part of the worldwide protests of Global Days of Action.
And now we go to Paul Cienfuegos for a weekly segment on taking back our authority to govern ourselves.
Greetings. You are listening to the new weekly commentary by yours truly, Paul Cienfuegos. A little more than 1 week ago, an estimated 400,000 people marched in New York City, demanding bold action from our federal government on the catastrophic climate destabilization that is already causing havoc across the planet. Climate activists were quick to point out that the numbers of people that showed up far exceeded their expectations, and that this proves once and for all that Americans do care about this issue. The implication being that our federal government is not yet acting boldly on the climate issue because Americans aren't well enough informed yet to be pressuring government to act. I reject that analysis. Polls have been showing for years now that something in the range of half of us think the climate issue is a priority that must be addressed. That's more than 100 million of us. So clearly the problem is not lack of public attention. I would argue that the real problem that needs to be addressed is a democracy problem, that it really doesn't matter what the American people want because we're not the people that our elected officials are paying much attention to.
We live in a society that's designed to appear as if it was democratic in its design, when in fact it's really designed to serve the 1% and the corporations they run. Government is functioning exactly as it was designed. It's not broken at all. So if we start with a different assumption, that our elected officials aren't really that interested in what we the people want, then we can start shifting our collective focus away from begging and pleading with them and towards the building of real political power in a more direct way, relearning the lost art of exercising our inherent right to govern ourselves. The community rights movement has been leading the way in these efforts since 1999, helping we the people to pass legally binding rights-based laws directly where we live that can be used to protect our air, water, and soil. For example, by banning corporate fracking, corporate water withdrawal for bottling, or corporate factory farms, because those corporate activities violate our right to clean air, water, and soil. To give you a more specific example, four New Hampshire communities recently passed local laws enshrining their right to a sustainable energy future. Their method was absolutely fascinating and cutting edge. They came up with their own definition of unsustainable energy, and then they banned any energy production in or distribution through their town that matches their new definition. In other words, in Sugar Hill and three other New Hampshire communities, it's now illegal for a corporation to generate or distribute any unsustainable energy. Imagine that. Talk about taking ourselves seriously as we the people. Do we really think that President Obama and his Democratic Party have the backbone to pass bold legislation to address the climate crisis, even if they were to regain their majority in the House and Senate? Do we really think that the Republican Party is prepared to honestly address the climate crisis? Let's get real. Virtually all of the key decision-making that impacts the global climate isn't even being made by politicians. It's being made by corporate boards of directors behind locked doors. And those corporate boards have a protected constitutional right to decide to keep drilling and fracking for more oil and gas, a constitutional right to decide to keep building bigger cars and trucks. These boards have a protected constitutional right to decide that our economy is going to grow forever as if our planet has infinite resources. So any strategy that climate activists use to try to turn around this climate crisis is going to have to directly and frontally challenge these corporate constitutional so-called rights. We're really wasting our time if all we continue to do is beg and plead with our politicians to act boldly on the climate crisis, because within this conventional framework of law, there's little that politicians are willing or able to do. On the other hand, if we step outside of these conventional tactics of begging and pleading and demanding, a whole new world opens up to us, a world where we decide which corporate activities are permitted and which are not. Yes, it's a very long road if we're going to have to address the climate crisis one community and one county at a time, at least initially. But I'm convinced that we'll actually get to our intended goal much faster than if we continue on our present course, and we're quickly running out of time. You've been listening to the new weekly commentary by yours truly, Paul Cienfuegos. You can hear future commentaries every Tuesday on the KBOO Evening News. I welcome your feedback. You can subscribe to my new weekly podcast via iTunes or at communityrightspdx.org. You can sign up for my newsletter at paulcienfuegos.com. Thanks for listening, and remember, we are the people we've been waiting for.
A federal bankruptcy judge has essentially turned off the water to thousands of Detroiters as part of a settlement involving the Detroit Water and Sewer Department. But a number of advocacy and human rights groups are vowing to keep fighting to get the water turned back on. KBOO's Don Merrill has more.
Federal Judge Stephen J. Rhodes for the Eastern District of Michigan declared yesterday that citizens have no implicit right to water. With that decision, the judge said the court could not stop shutoffs from a water district he said was suffering from the effects of Detroit's bankruptcy.
Yes, this is an ongoing struggle between the people of the city of Detroit against the emergency manager, the banks, and the corporations who are right now attempting to restructure the city using the federal bankruptcy courts.
That was Abayomi Azikiwe. He's an organizer for the advocacy group Moratorium Now, one of several plaintiffs in a lawsuit against the city of Detroit and its water and sewer department to try to get the city to not shut off the water to nearly 20,000 homes. The consortium filed a class action lawsuit against the city of Detroit on July 21st.
And the decision essentially was that if you can't afford to pay for water, irrespective of how the rates are determined, then you don't have a right for access to water. So it's an unfortunate decision, but it's really not surprising considering the overall atmosphere that exists now in the United States.
Well, I know that most utilities have payment plans that people can set up, or they offer some kind of payment assistance for those utilities that people are behind on. I mean, doesn't the DWSD offer those kinds of supports to Detroit water users?
The plans and programs are almost non-existent. They say this to the public, but in actuality, when people make phone calls to try to arrange to get assistance, either there's no answer or they're told there are no more funds available. So we were trying to institute a water affordability plan where approximately 2% of the monthly income, people could not pay more than that for water services. This would be more of a sustainable program for maintaining service for people throughout the city as well as throughout the region, because the DWSD just doesn't service Detroit. They service other suburban areas as well.
Mr. Azikiwe puts the blame for the shutoff at the feet of Kevin Orr, the emergency manager for the city of Detroit. He says the agenda of the city is to force as many poor and working people out of the city as possible while profiting from the privatization of private assets, land grabs, pension thefts, and health care terminations. Now, you had said that DWSD serves not just the city of Detroit, but the surrounding metropolitan areas. Are any other areas suffering from water shutoffs other than the central area in Detroit?
Yeah, it's region-wide. They have emphasized their attention more on Detroit because they have a political agenda. And that agenda is tied in with this illegal emergency management system that the voters in the state of Michigan voted against in November of 2012, however, was reimposed in a lame duck session by the two houses of the state government in Lansing and the governor, all of whom are extreme right-wing ideologues. So this is totally against the popular will of the people of the city of Detroit and the state of Michigan.
Mr. Azikiwe said Michigan had one of the most advanced water systems in the country, but due to a combination of neglect and crushing financial mismanagement and debt imposed by big banks, the system suffers inefficiencies that result in huge amounts of water waste.
And the cost is incalculable. In fact, the Detroit Water and Sewage Department admitted in open federal court that they did not even know the cost or the degree in which water was being wasted in the city of Detroit and through the DWSD system.
And when asked what those thousands of people would do, Mr. Azikiwe's answer was blunt.
They do not care what happens to people who have children, people who are senior citizens, who have disabilities, who have chronic illnesses, who do not have access to water. They, in fact, even recognized in Roe's decision that harm was being done.
But Mr. Azikiwe said the creditors convinced the court that more harm was being done by not forcing the city into bankruptcy to pay on its debt to those creditors. Are there any nonprofit organizations or other organizations that are trying to provide people with bottled water or water to wash their clothes with or something?
Yeah, there are a number of organizations and churches. We've had delegations from Canada, from West Virginia, from Utah, from Chicago that have brought gallons of water to Detroit, but it's just a drop in the ocean. You cannot substitute access to tap water with bottled water.
I'm Don Merrill, KBOO News.
You're listening to the KBOO Evening News. Stay tuned after the newscast for an interview with Tori Russell for Hands Up United about the latest in the protest and the uprisings in Ferguson, Missouri. followed by Out Loud at 6. Tonight's Out Loud welcomes singer-songwriter and artist Max Voltage. Also on Out Loud, Oregon Safe Schools and Communities Coalition to discuss upcoming events around the local queer community. At 7, it's Hard Knock Radio news and views from a hip-hop perspective. Tonight's Hard Knock Radio interviews Filipinos' contribution to hip-hop, as well as Bruce Dixon of the Black Agenda Report and a classic speech by Malcolm X. Tomorrow's weather is partly cloudy with a high of 64 degrees and a night low of 46 degrees. Today in history, in 1955, actor James Dean, 24, was killed in a two-car collision near Chelem, California. In 1962, James Meredith, a black student, was escorted by federal marshals to the campus of the University of Mississippi, where he enrolled for classes the next day. Meredith's presence sparked rioting that claimed two lives. Also in 1962, the National Farm Workers Association, founded by Cesar Chavez and a forerunner to the United Farm Workers, held its first meeting in Fresno, California. The quote of the day is from one of the earliest of abolitionist and freedom fighters, Frederick Douglass. "Where justice is denied, where poverty is enforced, where ignorance prevails, and where any one class is made to feel that society is an organized conspiracy to oppress, rob, and degrade them, neither persons nor property will be safe."
It's 5:21, time for daily commentary from Jim Hightower.
What's the matter with the post office? The U.S. Postal Service, I mean, the corporate hierarchy that runs this enormously popular public institution. Yes, I know that USPS has lost revenue it traditionally got from first-class mail delivery. But I also know that letter carriers and postal workers have offered many excellent ideas for expanding the services that USPS can deliver, thus increasing both revenue and the importance of maintaining these community treasures. Yet, the Postal Board of Governors, which includes corporate interests that would profit by killing the public service, seems intent on, guess what, killing it. The board's only idea is to cut services and shut down hundreds of local post offices. Incredibly, their list of closures include the historic post office in Philadelphia's Old City, the very building where Ben Franklin presided as our country's first Postmaster General, appointed by the Continental Congress in 1775. All across the country, post offices that are invaluable artistic and historic assets are slated to be sold to developers. One is the marvelous 1935 Bronx Post Office, with classical architectural flourishes and 13 museum-worthy murals. "It's not just a post office," says one customer fighting the closure. "It's part of my life." No one feels that way about a FedEx warehouse. Yet, says a USPS spokeswoman dismissively, the four-story building is severely underused. This is Jim Hightower saying, so use it. Put a coffee shop in it, a public internet facility, a library and museum, a one-stop government services center, and, as USPS employees have suggested, a public bank offering basic services to the thousands of neighborhood people ignored by commercial banks. Come on, USPS, show a little creativity and gumption, and remember that service is a key part of your name.
What do the corporate powers from Wall Street to Walmart have in common? They hate the Hightower Lowdown. You can see why at www.hightowerlowdown.org.
And now we hear the latest in worker-related news from our friends at laborradio.org.
You're listening to WIN, Workers Independent News, a production of Diversified Media Enterprises. I'm Doug Cunningham. UAW Secretary Treasurer Gary Castile says German unions and the UAW are uniting in a U.S. Southern organizing effort. Castile told the Chattanooga Times Free Press that the German union and the UAW will both put resources into the effort to organize VW's Chattanooga plant. A letter of intent was signed by UAW leaders, German union IG Metall officials, and the Volkswagen German Works Council, taking their solidarity to a new level at VW here in the U.S. And there's no reason to believe that international solidarity will stop there, because IG Metall also represents BMW and Mercedes workers in Germany. Both companies operate auto production facilities in the U.S. Reuters reports that it obtained a copy of the letter of intent to jointly organize VW's Chattanooga plant. The UAW now reportedly has more than half the workers at that plant signed up in UAW Local 42. It does not yet, though, have a formal agreement with VW to recognize that local as the collective bargaining representative for the workers. That VW plant intends to add as many as 2,000 more workers by 2016. Vote totals are finally out in the railroad workers' vote on one-man trains at BSNF. J.P. Wright, co-chair of Railroad Workers United, says 3,056 rail workers voted against the one-man crew, while 623 workers voted for it. Wright says that the 5-to-1 vote against the one-man crews is a loud and clear decision by the workers that they will not be bribed and fooled by a smoke-and-mirrors contract that he says sells out their safety and that of the communities the trains run through in order to subsidize corporate profits. An executive order from New York City Mayor Bill de Blasio expands the city's living wage law to approximately 18,000 more families. Mayor de Blasio is also seeking authority from state government to match New York City's minimum wage to a living wage citywide. If he gets the authority, it would mean all New York City hourly workers would earn at least $15 an hour by 2019. The fast food worker Fight for 15 movement to get a $15 an hour minimum wage started in New York City. That movement, launched by about 200 workers, is credited for having sparked a wave of efforts nationwide that's still gaining momentum. Organized labor is joining the Hong Kong democracy protests. The International Trade Union Confederation says the Hong Kong Teachers Union is strongly supporting the protests and joining strike actions. 500 academics have signed a statement of support for students and workers in the streets. AFL-CIO President Rich Trumka says Hong Kong students, workers, and citizens are bravely standing up for democracy and the right to peaceably assemble. ITUC General Secretary Sharon Burrow said that China's plan to allow a few billionaires to choose who will rule Hong Kong is anti-democratic and in breach of China's 1997 undertakings on Hong Kong's future. You've been listening to WIND, Workers' Independent News. For more information, visit laborradio.org.
The first confirmed case in the United States of Ebola virus has been diagnosed. Four other American patients had been treated in the past few months for Ebola, but they were healthcare workers who had been kept in isolation from the time they left Africa. In this case, however, the patient came from Liberia and boarded a plane to Texas. He was out in public for more than a week before reporting to a Dallas hospital with symptoms of the deadly virus. The patient, who has been isolated since his symptoms were recognized, is an unnamed man at Texas Health Presbyterian Hospital in Dallas. It is not known if he has exposed others. The man left Liberia on September 19th and arrived in the USA the next day, but had no symptoms when leaving Africa or arriving here, said Thomas Frieden of the Centers for Disease Control in Atlanta, Georgia, or the CDC. He was admitted to the Texas hospital on September 28th. I have no doubt that we will control this case of Ebola so that it does not spread widely in this country, said Frieden of the CDC on Tuesday. It is certainly possible that someone who has contact with this patient could develop Ebola, but there is no doubt in my mind that we will stop it here, said Mr. Frieden. Ebola does not spread through the air like measles or the flu. Ebola patients are only contagious once they begin showing symptoms such as fever, diarrhea, and vomiting. Someone with these symptoms could infect healthcare workers, such as those working in an emergency room. However, the virus is only spread through contact with bodily fluids such as blood or vomit. Infectious disease experts agree with Frieden of the CDC that Ebola is unlikely to spread very far in the USA, however, because of stringent infection control measures in place at American hospitals. A doctor exposed to Ebola has been quarantined in Washington, D.C. as well. The unknown doctor was exposed while working in Sierra Leone, which has been hit hard by the recent Ebola outbreak. The quarantine doctor has not yet shown signs of contracting the illness and is undergoing medical quarantine as a precautionary measure.
Pro-democracy demonstrations in Hong Kong continued on Monday night as thousands of protesters occupied another major road in Hong Kong. The new sit-in was marked by police presence, but no tear gas was reported, in contrast with Sunday, when 87 rounds of tear gas were fired. Recent protests in Hong Kong began after the Chinese government announced that in Hong Kong's first governmental election in 2017, the Chinese government will have to approve all candidates.
And now, the latest news and developments from the occupied territories in Palestine from the International Middle East Media Center in Bethlehem.
Welcome to Palestine Today, a service of the International Middle East Media Center at www.imemc.org for Monday, September 29th, 2014. Israeli settler hit a Palestinian child with his car and troops kidnapped civilians during pre-dawn invasions targeting West Bank communities. These stories and more coming up. Stay tuned. Palestinian medical sources have reported on Sunday evening that a child was injured after being struck by a settler's car east of Yatta town, south of the southern West Bank city of Hebron. The sources said that the child, Islam Al-Amur, 6 years of age, suffered a number of fractures, cuts and bruises to different parts of the body and was moved to Al-Hilal Hospital in the city. Similar to various prior incidents, the settler fled the scene. Later on Monday morning, a number of Israeli military jeeps invaded the northern West Bank city of Jenin and broke into a coffee shop and a bakery. Israeli soldiers also kidnapped at least 10 Palestinians in different parts of the occupied West Bank, including 7 in Karawit Bani Hassan village near the northern West Bank city of Qalqilya. One Palestinian was kidnapped in Tul Karim city, also in the northern part of the West Bank, and at least one in Dura town, south of the southern West Bank city of Hebron, and two in Al-Jalazon refugee camp, north of Ramallah and central West Bank. Elsewhere, Israeli forces demolished 3 floors of a residential Palestinian building in occupied East Jerusalem's Abu Dis neighborhood overnight Sunday, claiming that the owners lacked a building permission. Israel destroyed more than 500 Palestinian properties in the West Bank and East Jerusalem in year 2013 alone, displacing over 850 people, according to United Nations calculations. In related news, the Palestinian Prisoner Society reported that Israeli authorities have imprisoned 560 Palestinians since the beginning of this September alone. According to the PPS records, Hebron province has witnessed the highest rate of imprisonment with 163 prisoners, followed by Jenin province with 108. And that's all for today from the IMEMC News. This was the Monday, September 29th, 2014 news roundup from the occupied Palestinian territories. For more news and updates, please visit our website at www.imemc.org. Today's report has been brought to you by George Shmawi and me, Ghassan Bannoura. U.S. airstrikes continued in Syria last night, this time joined for the first time by the British Air Force. We go now to commentator Jeffrey Blankfort, who challenges the assumptions made by the Obama administration in its attack on the so-called Islamic State fighters.
Latest news from U.S.-occupied Afghanistan. The new Afghan government has concluded crucial security pacts with the U.S. and NATO. The previous government had resisted signing the security pact as it paves the way for roughly 12,000 foreign troops to remain in the country after the end of this year. The long-delayed agreements were signed a day after President Ashraf Ghani took office, marking his administration's first major act. Combined, the security deals will allow international troops to remain in Afghanistan after December to focus on two missions: training Afghan security forces and conducting so-called counterterrorism operations. They are directly linked to the continued delivery of billions of dollars in aid to the Afghan government and its armed forces. At a ceremony held in Kabul's presidential palace Tuesday afternoon, Afghan's newly designated national security advisor signed the two pacts on behalf of his country. Mr. Ghani made a surprise appearance at the ceremony to defend the deal and explain it to the Afghan public. The agreements, he said, would respect Afghan sovereignty. Protesters continue to challenge the authority of the new president, claiming voter suppression and fraud in the recent election that brought Ghani to office in Afghanistan over Abdullah Abdullah.
And now, National Native News.
This is National Native News. I'm Antonia Gonzalez. The United Nations General Assembly adopted an agreement called the Outcome Document Monday that provides measures to implement the UN Declaration on the Rights of Indigenous Peoples. The declaration was adopted in 2007. Monday's move happened during the first-ever World Conference on Indigenous Peoples being held in New York City. The outcome document focuses on four priorities: to set up a body to monitor the implementation of the declaration, to establish a permanent status for Indigenous governments at the UN, prevent violence against Indigenous women, and protect sacred sites. Robert Coulter, executive director of the Indian Law Resource Center, says Indigenous people, including from tribes in the U.S., participated in creating the document.
It was a wonderful moment. The hundreds of Indigenous participants who were in the General Assembly Hall rose to their feet and applauded, celebrated, and it was a very good moment because of what the Indigenous nations and peoples have been able to achieve.
Coulter says details still need to be worked out. The Indigenous conference wraps up today. Native people are also in New York this week participating in events to address climate change as world leaders meet at the UN for a climate summit. Events this week included a march and lectures. Indigenous activists are voicing concerns about fracking, uranium mining, and protecting natural resources. Tribal leaders are now looking to the Obama administration to take action in the U.S. British Columbia's political leaders recently sat down with First Nations for an all-chiefs meeting. It's the first meeting since the Supreme Court of Canada upheld a BC First Nations right to more than 400,000 acres of land in the province. Dan Karpinchuk reports.
It was the first time ever British Columbia Premier Christy Clark and her cabinet sat down for talks with all 203 of BC's First Nations. And among her first actions was to formally acknowledge Aboriginal title. She could hardly do otherwise in the wake of a high court ruling which expanded and clarified that title.
My position on that hasn't changed. I want to get a negotiated agreement. I intend to get one. And I think as long as we keep our eyes focused on that goal, it will remain within our reach. The minute we take our eyes off that goal, I think it will begin to elude us.
Until now, Clark has shown little inclination to tackle the 150-year-old land question. The unprecedented meeting took more than 2 years to organize, but not nearly as much as what went into winning the case before the country's highest court. Ed John is the Grand Chief of the First Nations Summit.
That's a tremendous amount of resources, tremendous amount of cost, tremendous amount of time of our elders. That's been a part of this long, long and difficult struggle. Now we're at a place where the courts have said, these people are right.
John says First Nations communities are now in a better position to benefit and manage resource development. There was, however, no major breakthrough at the summit. Many elders were hoping for at least a joint statement on title recognition and revenue sharing. Clark did offer some progress on certain economic projects, but she sidestepped the issues of rights and reconciliation. For National Native News, I'm Dan Karpinchuk.
The U.S. Justice Department announced Monday more than $87 million in grants will address tribal law enforcement and crime prevention efforts. Nine areas are being focused on, including justice systems planning, substance abuse, and youth programs. 169 tribal grants were awarded nationally. The American Indian Alaska Native Tourism Association honored some of the best Indian country destinations during an awards ceremony last week in Louisiana. The 2014 awards went to the Alaska Tourism Corporation, Alaska Native Voices in Huna, and the best tribal destination to Chickasaw Country in Oklahoma. I'm Antonia Gonzalez. You're listening to the KBOO Evening News. This is a volunteer-produced newscast, and we encourage your participation. Call us with your breaking news stories at 503-231-8032. Our production team for tonight's newscast is James Aquavella, Tani Gomez-Diaz, Don Merrill, Jared Dantzler, and Jessica Abel. The producer and engineer is Sequoia Wright. The KBOO Evening News and Public Affairs Director is Jenka Soderberg. A podcast of local stories from this newscast is available on our website at kboo.fm/eveningnews or look for us on Twitter at KBOO News. If you'd like to call your elected representative about any issue you've heard on the news tonight, here are the phone numbers, so get a pen or something to write with. The local number for Senator Ron Wyden is 503-326-7525. The number for Senator Jeff Merkley is 503-326-3386. Oregon Governor Kitzhaber's number is 503-378-3111. Portland Mayor Charlie Hales can be reached at 503-823-4120. You are listening to KBOO Portland, 90.7 FM, K282BH Philomath, 104.3 FM, and K220HR Hood River, 91.9 FM. I'm Emily Young.
And I'm Theo Burke. Coming up tomorrow morning on KBOO, we have a big day. At 7 a.m., it's Democracy Now! With Amy Goodman and Juan Gonzalez. And at 8 a.m., we begin our special day named Turning the Tide on Climate Change, Cutting-Edge Thinkers and Activists on How to Avert a Global Catastrophe. As Paul Rowland interviews Corey Morningstar, investigative journalist, writer, and environmental activist who has been investigating the political and financial influences on the climate change movement. At 9 a.m., we hear experts from Disruption, a documentary film featuring some of the environmental movement's top leaders calling for a new strategy to address the climate crisis. At 10 a.m., Air Cascadia, Chris Andrei speaks with Hari Wasserman about his article, How We Will Win on Climate Change. 10:30 a.m., we have Sharman Apt Russell. She talks about her book, Diary of a Citizen Scientist. At 11 a.m., the KBOO Bike Show. And at 1 p.m., we have Naomi Klein, the award-winning journalist, syndicated columnist, and author who writes for The Nation magazine. She will be live in the KBOO studios to talk about her new book, This Changes Everything, Capitalism Versus the Climate. And at 2 p.m., Andrew Geller speaks with Naomi Oreskes, co-author of the new book, The Collapse of Western Civilization, A View from the Future, and George Marshall, author of Don't Even Think About It, Why Our Brains Are Wired to Ignore Climate Change. And now stay tuned for a live interview conducted by KBOO reporters.
KBOO News In Depth, where we take a deeper look at the top news stories impacting our community.
A board coalition of activists and local organizations in Ferguson, Missouri are calling again for the Ferguson Police Chief Thomas Jackson to resign after a new round of police attacks on peaceful protesters last week. Five protesters were arrested as a result, but have since been released. One organization is working toward building national momentum to bring justice to the people of Ferguson, Missouri, and for the murder of Michael Brown. Hands Up United is one that is organizing support for a weekend of resistance, which starts October 10th. KBOO's Sequoyna Wright spoke with Tori Russell of Hands Up United about the recent updates in Missouri and the weekend of events around fighting for justice.
All right, so Tori, the first question I want to ask, five protesters were arrested last week during peaceful protesting last week, but have since been released. What prompted the police to arrest these protesters in the first place? What happened?
I don't think there's any rules to it. If they see you and you have any kind of influence on the crowd, if you come out, and you can bring other people out, or you can keep the energy out, they target you. A month ago, I was targeted. A couple of days ago, Tef Poe with Hands Up United, they were targeted. Even one of our people, Abby, recording Lost Voices camp being raided, recording the officers to get you, arrested. There's really no rules of it. It's just whoever they deem that day to be influential or to be powerful, or the people who put up the most resistance at the protest, you'll be retaliated against. And I mean forms of being followed or threatened, being called an animal, any kind of thing. And that always leads to arrest. So I don't know what the rules of engagement are. I do know that coming to Ferguson, if you're influential, you will be arrested.
And there's been a call for the resignation of the police chief of Ferguson Police, Police Chief Thomas Jackson. What's being done with that? What's the update on that?
I don't know, man. As we got a mayor, like he even said in his own words, that he went from being the police chief in a small town and probably being one of the most famous and known police chiefs in the country. Clearly, he's in over his head. He doesn't know what he's doing. A couple of days ago, he chose to march with the people, and he couldn't even control his own officers. When the officers just began to run up and throw people down, the police chief was, he was not in power. He's not in control of his own officers. You have officers, they're wearing I Am Darren Wilson wristbands. They're not wearing their ID. And this doesn't just go for Chief Jackson. This is Chief Belmore in St. Louis County. He's not in control. Also Captain Johnson, a black face is what I kind of see him as. He's just, he's the mental mind of a white person, a white supremacy, but he just has a black face to it. All those people are not accountable. They're not in control, and they need to resign today. Just last night, Captain Johnson said he was unaware of the five-second rule, which I haven't even heard of a five-second rule other than, if you're dropping some food on the floor. The five-second rule is if they shoot a shot in the air, or if you stop walking for 5 seconds, you are subject to arrest. So, just standing peacefully assembling and protesting for 5 seconds, you are subject to arrest by some magical law that I've never heard of. And I guess it circumvents your First Amendment right through the Constitution.
So is that what's going on? Are they making up rules as they go along just to curtail from the main point, which is to prosecute Darren Wilson to the fullest extent of the law?
Oh, most definitely. When you have officers not having name badges, we're showing the video to the police chief. he said that he's unaware, right? Chief Jackson, he's unaware. We show Belmore that his officers in St. Louis counties, they're not wearing theirs. He's not aware. Captain Johnson, he said he's not in control, or he doesn't make up the laws, but he enforces the laws in real time on the ground, and he's not aware of that. He wasn't even aware that his own officers were wearing the I Am Darren Wilson wristbands. So they're making up laws as you go. So what we do on the ground, I think Saturday, we had like the best protest ever. So they said that we had to keep moving and we couldn't get in the street. So some young people went home and got their bikes, rode the bikes in the bike lane, slowed down traffic. Then they said that just us chanting violated the noise ordinance. So we went to the business district. And we banged on pots and pans and brought drums and chanted all night because there's no noise ordinance that we're breaking in the business district on a weekend.
Yeah.
So we're finding ways around these new lies. I wouldn't call them laws. I would just call them new lies that they're making up and throwing them in. We had ACLU fighting them and everybody else. So we just have to be creative until justice comes. So
yeah.
Until then, we're just going to do crazy stuff.
Well, here's another question to you, Tori, is to the best of your knowledge and your comrades that are on the ground right now seeking justice, what is the energy of the police in Ferguson and in St. Louis currently right now? Are they being aggressive than normal? Are they being arrogant in their stance? Like, what's their energy like?
I think that they're defeated. They look defeated in the face. Every time they come with a new law or some new way to stop the peaceful protest, they come with a way to, plant people or put people in the crowd or allow other people in the community to do things that we couldn't do. So it's a pizza place, Farachi Pizza, on South Florissant. The owner brought out a gun and threatened us with a gun right in front of the police. And then he drove up the street and did the same thing. Then he went on the news and he told the news that he did it, right? And no one says anything, right? And the police are just in shock. They don't know what to do. You know, so for weeks, we've been backing them up, making them move back, making them call in every municipality and small town around Ferguson, and they don't know what to do. They're bewildered. They don't know who to talk to, who to calm people down, or nothing. But all they would have to do is start resigning and arrest Darren Wilson and indict him and fire him, and it would be calm, but it would be a better step towards justice.
Well, I mean, why aren't they? I mean, what are their reasons? What are you hearing in local media and where you live? What are the reasons why they're not indicting Darren Wilson for the murder of Michael Brown? What's the reason?
I mean, the same reason that Trayvon and everybody else, you know.
Right, okay.
Wait till you die to say due process. They don't say due process while you're alive with your hands up. They wait till a black dead to scream due process, right? After the execution, then they say, well, think about the system, and the system needs to stay intact only after the body hits the ground. I don't know what that is, but I know that's not due process.
And how about the on-the-ground regular citizens who are just seeking justice for Michael Brown and just, you know, getting justice for the criminal behavior of the police? What's their energy like right now?
I mean, after Saturday night, the young people were happy. I would describe the drums and the pots and pans. Their energy was up. I would say it was like a New Orleans funeral where we were grieving, but we weren't crying. So the energy is great as long as we feel that we're defeating the local police department. But I think it's time to put pressure on the prosecutor, Bob McCullough, and more importantly, Jay Nixon. He's on. He just came back from his fourth Middle East tour. And while, you know, he's talking about the war over there as if ISIS is not the Ferguson Police Department. As if he doesn't have a war right here in his own backyard. So he's preoccupied with, I don't know, but he needs to be here. And if he can't, if he doesn't want to do this job right now, I don't know what job he wants to do, but I don't think the governor seat is for him at this time, because I don't know what he's doing.
What about the Black African American city councilman on the Ferguson board? How are they reacting? Are they resigning? Are they protesting? Like, what's going on with them?
Most of the elected officials here are not protesting. You have a couple local ones. Patricia Bynes, she's out there. And Antonio French has been out there every day.
Yeah, we've been hearing about Antonio French. Yeah. He's been out there. Yeah. He's the alderman.
Yeah, he's an alderman, and he's actually my alderman in the city. So he's not even the alderman out there. But the people who actually live out there, they're not coming out. So I don't, you know, so they're trying to, I guess they're trying to figure out what they can do. And I believe if they came to sit down with the youth organizers that are out there, they could figure out what to do. You know, starting up some legislation about a Mike Brown law about killing unarmed young black or unarmed people in general, about what the process is in the automatic firing if you shoot someone. And then if you're convicted, you should lose your license forever. You shouldn't be allowed to go jump from town to town killing people and having your slate clean.
Mm. So, Tori, before we end this interview tonight, there are scheduled events around the injustices of Michael Brown and just injustices overall. Can you tell us more about those events happening in October?
Yeah, so Hands Up United, an organization for Black Struggle and more, and some other local groups, Don't Shoot Coalition, we're coming together for national mobilization October 10th through October 13th. We have a march on the 11th, but we're calling it a weekend of resistance. So when you come here on the 10th, it will be not only trainings, but nonviolent civil disobedience all through the city from the 10th. The 11th, the 12th, and 13th to wrap up Columbus Day, which I would probably like to say more of Indigenous Peoples Day. It's just going to be protests all through the city. The city will not be able to go on as business as usual that weekend. So we're calling for everybody to come here. I think this is the best place at the best time at that weekend to start the long walk to freedom. It won't end with or without this indictment, but if our feet are on the ground in Ferguson, then we can always call places for everyone to come to rally around for justice and freedom for all.
And give our listeners information on where they can find out about these scheduled events in October.
So you can go to FergusonOctober.com, where you can go hit the button, say I'm going to be there, and you can go to HandsUpUnited.org. You can also click the link, and you know, just a simple sign-in, will you be here? And then on HandsUpUnited.org, we have a message board, so if you say, hey, I need a room, I need a couch, anybody got a van to come pick us up, message board, we'll reply yes, meet me here, we'll meet you there. On FergusonOctober.com, we have hotels and churches that you can plug in. So you can, when you get here, you'll know where the training is going to be, where the civil disobedience at, what cities and what towns we're going to shut down that weekend, and you plug right in. So you can go to Ferguson October for the training and some of the hotel things. You can go to HandsUpUnited.org, and you can find out about some of the protests and also the message boards about a couch or a room or a bed.
Right. I have been speaking with Tori Russell for Hands Up United about the recent events in Ferguson, Missouri. Thank you very much, Tori, for your commentary. And I'm Sequoia Wright with KBOO Evening News.
Hey. Thanks for having me.
This KBOO program is made possible in part by KBOO Foundation members and a grant from Portland's Gay Directory, providing a resource guide of openly gay-friendly businesses, organizations, and services since 1996. New smartphone app available for all iPhones and Droids. For more information, you can visit gaypdx.com.
This program is made possible in part by KABU Foundation members and a grant from Radio Cab, serving the metro area since 1946 with service 24 hours a day, 365 days a year. Radio Cab offers airport service, wheelchair-accessible vans, and can be reached at 503-227-1212. In Vancouver at 360-694-1234 or RadioCab.net.
KABU is proud to co-sponsor the Friends of Jordan 5K and Kids Run, Saturday, October 11th at 9 a.m. Friends of Jordan is an organization that provides support for families as they go through the trials of serious childhood illness. This fun run and walk will raise funds for Adult in Reno, a 22-month-old from Salem. Again, that's the Friends of Jordan 5K and Kids Run on Saturday, October 11th at 9 a.m. at Forest Grove High School, 1401 Nichols Lane in Forest Grove. More information can be found at kabu.fm on the right side of the home page under Community Events.
What's up, everybody? This is Goddess and She, and you're tuning in to KBOO Portland. Holla at your girl.
Welcome to Out Loud, the queer culture radio show on KBOO Portland. My name is Carla, and tonight we have three special guests that are going to be joining me in studio. First, we're going to be speaking with Max Voltage, who is an artist and a musician and an event producer who's been on Out Loud a couple times in the past. Hopefully, you're already familiar with Home Momentum. There was a musical recently, last fall, and Max is here tonight to share some music from Home Momentum and to talk about an upcoming boy band that Max is putting together to continue the love of Home Momentum into the future. We're also going to be hearing from Dom, who is involved with St.